Well, good evening, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore in Scottsdale, Arizona, and we are delighted to have Michelle Wilgen with us this evening to discuss her brand new book, Wine People. And I have copies of the trade paperback edition, and there are a couple copies of the autographed hardcover as well. I'll go ahead and put a link in the comments field if you're interested in purchasing one. And if you have questions, go ahead and put them in. And Barbara usually will bring me on screen towards the end of the hour, and I will be happy to ask any questions you might have. So Barbara, over to you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Michelle, what a pleasure to meet you. I was going to say this is your debut novel, but then I looked up your biography and I see you're a writer of large experience. And I have to say that I'm sorry that I missed Food and Booze, a 10-house literary feast. Wow. You've written quite a lot, and you've also written for various journals and so forth. So what brought you to write Wine People?
So, you know, I was hitting a point where I had to think about, like, what's the next thing I want to write? And I wanted it to be, I just wanted some fun. And then I think I just have been working extra hard, and I wanted to think of something that I would enjoy reading about and that I would enjoy researching. And years ago, when I graduated from college, I had wanted to get into writing about food and wine, just somehow. I didn't really know how, but I've been reading Fisher and Larry Colwin and really wanted to do something like what they did. And the problem was that I didn't know anything. And so when I sat down to try and write something, I was like, well, I have absolutely nothing to say. So I got a job at the best restaurant I could find and hoped that they would teach me about food and wine. And as it happened, they really did. Mm. So this was a place called L'Etoile in Madison. It's still around. And the chef owner was married to a wine importer. And so that was my first taste of experiencing wine dinners and a place with a really wonderful wine program, and just getting a suddenly realize it, like getting an insight into where this comes from, because I hadn't really thought about it before. And I was really struck by the idea that this product that we think of as so luxurious and so refined, and you know, it's expensive and we drink it in fancy places, that it's an agricultural product. And that really, when you go to visit these producers, you're visiting farmers. And so I always kind of had that opposition in my head as just something interesting. And so when it was time for me to think, well, what do I want to write about? I thought, well, I'll just ask a few questions and I'll talk to a few people who work in wine and just see, like, is it interesting? And sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you poke around and nothing lights up. And in this case, I was like, oh, this is fascinating. I just want to figure it all out. And so I had to do a lot of research to find out the world before I had any idea what the story was going to be.
Well, it is indeed a complex worldwide industry and very competitive. I have chased wine all over the world. I'm handicapped by the fact that my capacity for alcohol appears to be a glass. I'm just a terrible drinker, which is too bad because I love it. And I did bring to show you, because we're going to be talking about wine importing, this beautiful bottle, which is made by Delheim in Stellenbosch, South Africa. It's a Pinotage Rosé. My husband and I were traveling in South Africa, and we specifically went to the wine district, which, for those of you who know your history, was largely started by the French who got booted out, the Protestant French, who got booted out of France and settled, many of them, in South Africa. The problem was, even though we loved this, we couldn't get it. Mm-hmm. You could not find it here in the U.S. And my husband went through extraordinary lengths to find an importer that eventually agreed to supply us with Delheim, which we had to more or less subscribe to. And I think that's an interesting thing, Michelle, in that it's not that easy. You can't just go, you know, down to your local wine store and get whatever you want. It's a really complicated, heavily regulated industry, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, it's that was one of the things that really came to interest me about it, that people are making tons of wine all over the world, and somebody has to encounter a wine, fall in love with it, think that it is something that they can tell a story about and then they can sell and that they will put their time and money behind. And in that way, honestly, it is a lot like publishing. You know, somebody over somewhere is laboring over making a thing that may or may not work out, you know, but they're doing it for love and it takes a long time. And somebody else has to connect with it in what can be a very personal and idiosyncratic way and package it in a way that says, you know, you drinker, you consumer are going to enjoy this. And I was really struck by that.
I love your analogy. Why didn't I think of it? That's absolutely brilliant. You're right. It is tremendously like publishing, and partly that's because it combines creativity with business, with an unpredictable growing season and an unpredictable demand. I mean, breaks your heart when last I was in France, you know, the French were pouring out their wine because, you know, of the glut on the market. The first time we went to New Zealand, I can still remember driving along in the, I guess it must have been the North Island. And everywhere you looked, there was property for sale. Now, if you're in Scottsdale, what this means is a developer is going to be building houses. Mm-hmm. In New Zealand, what this really meant was that they were selling shares in upcoming or already established vineyards for people to invest in. I'm really serious. I mean, it was like a whole real estate thing unfolding around us, but it was specifically for people buying hectares of and particular kinds of grapes, furthermore. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I read something the other day that New Zealand has done such a brilliant job marketing its Sauvignon Blanc, which I absolutely love, that they make other good wines, but nobody knows or cares about them because they hear New Zealand and they think, okay, you know, it's going to be like Marlborough Region Sauvignon Blanc. And meantime, whatever lovely, you know, Merlot or Malbec or whatever they might be making, nobody cares.
Yeah, I know. It follows these fashions like anything else. You know, one of the things that the book has as a little timestamp is that it takes place before rosé was rosé. You know, there was a time when those of us who loved a dry French rosé felt kind of shamefaced about ordering it because people thought it was white Zin. And now you could barely remember that because, you know, rosé changed the whole market. Summer used to be a dead time for selling wine, and now it's huge, and it's because of rosé. So these things sort of come and go. And I think it's always an interesting glimpse into like what cultural shifts the wine is sort of helping illuminate.
Oh, that is so true. And rosé comes in all different shades. The one I showed you is really apricot. You know, it can come all the way from sort of pale pink to, I'm fascinated by, I'm also fascinated by ice wine, which I have encountered, amazingly enough, more on cruise ships than anything else. Well, they keep it around for dessert in case, you know, you've had enough. And now that grapes, I've just come back from Quebec. And, you know, now that climate shift's going on, there are serious vineyards being planted in Canada and in England. I think Scotland actually may have started planting grapes. And so, you know, as the climate shifts, I think we're going to see some changes in what grapes are grown, what grapes are marketed, what grapes people want to drink.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's moving. It's all slowly moving northward, and things are definitely shifting. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, in 10, 20 years, what's that going to look like?
It really will. I know. I've been on the whiskey trail in Scotland, and I thought it'd be fun if they have a parallel trail so you could zigzag back and forth between the whiskey.
Well, I cannot drink whiskey. It's too much leather tobacco. Like, I can never turn down wine, honestly, because there's such an endless variety within the world of a glass of wine that I am always just like, I could have that other thing, but then I'm not drinking wine. So do I really want to do that?
Well, I hear you. My husband's the whiskey drinker. I was just along for the ride. And also it was absolutely beautiful. So there we are. You know, wine also, I mean, I've been coming to Arizona since 1950 when I was 10 years old, when Scottsdale had two paved roads, wasn't incorporated, and you had to take a buckboard from airport, from Terminal 1, to get into Scottsdale. And so here we are today with this incredibly sophisticated community that has become from a place that had, as my uncle once said, my Chicago uncle said back in the 80s, many restaurants, none of them memorable. We've become a real restaurant, gourmet foodie sort of thing. And that means that wine has followed. And now there are wine pairings, wine dinners. We serve wine at the Poison Pen. You know, wine, you can just sort of pick one or two. You don't have to do, if you have an open bar and you have to have, you know, all kinds of stuff, that's hard. But if you offer people sort of like an airplane, you know, if you're flying what they laughingly call first class, please, they offer you, you know, like one white or one red. It's usually, unfortunately, a Chardonnay or a Cabernet Sauvignon, which I think is, I don't know whether it's cheap or just popular taste. And I can't drink either one because the histamines aggravate my rosacea. So there we go. But I think wine is simple as well as complicated was my point. You know, you can have a wonderful meal and just serve like one wine. You don't have to have an array, or you can dazzle people with.
Yeah, that's, I think, one of the great pleasures of it is a friend of mine had pointed out that there are so many different roads into being interested in wine, you know, that, mm-hmm. and the book has a little passage where I loved kind of going into this, that there are the people who get really into the science of it. They get into the chemistry of it and the story that it tells that's in there. Or people who are much more poetic and they just sort of are thinking about like all the things it makes you think of and what does wine do in our world? And people who are much more into the culinary world, you know, you want to see how does it pair? And then there's geography, there's history, there's all kinds of stuff that you can use wine as a lens to explore. And I think that's one of the real pleasures of it that you have. I was visiting a winery in Napa when I was doing a book tour thing a couple of weeks ago. And the winemaker said, you know, in a lot of ways, we are still making it the exact same way. You know, there's a few things that we do to make it a little easier on ourselves, like in terms of regulating temperature or whatever, but it's kind of the same thing that we did thousands of years ago in a lot of ways. And yet there are so many opportunities to screw it up, you know, and to get it right or to get it wrong. And it contains so many multitudes inside it. So it's, again, like, I think any writer is so excited to find these sort of poles of opposition, you know, things that are simple but simple but complicated, or, you know, luxurious, but they're agriculture and all that stuff that really is a place where good fiction usually lives.
That's a really very well said. And I'm thinking of all the places that I have gone to over time in which wine, there's a whole sort of luxury thing that comes up around wine, you know, luxury hotels, luxury vineyards. When I was an undergraduate, I have to tell you, like 1959 at Stanford, we used to make our way up to Napa back before there was one freeway called Bayshore, which was a death trap. And we used to stomp grapes, or we could go a little bit south down to, was it Saratoga? I can't quite remember, where they had a thing called Emerald Dry Riesling, which was slightly like lemonade, but with alcohol, whatever, you know, we were kids. But I mean, it was so simple. And then Napa suddenly, you know, turned into these, you know, like French chateau kinds of operations. I've been, one of the best ones I've ever been to is in southern Peru. I mean, just a magnificent and very old Spanish established, I think, hacienda, you know, with grape growing. So you can be a wine tourist. Mm-hmm. And do it, you can do it basically, or you can do it very extravagantly.
Yeah.
But let's talk about your book. We've wandered all around.
Oh, that's right. I was like, oh, yes, the book. Yeah.
I know. You know, well, here we are.
It's fun to talk about wine.
So I can quote from Oprah Daily, which calls wine people a riveting behind the scenes portrait of a high drama industry from the chateau to the corner office, which I really like. And it definitely can be a cutthroat world. And a difficult world for women, perhaps. So what, give us a bit of the narrative. What, you know, how do we start and what's your theme, so to speak, for the book?
Absolutely. So the book is centered around two women who are two of the only women who work at a boutique wine importer in New York City in the early aughts. And one of them was born into the wine world. She's the daughter of growers who supply very prestigious winemakers here in the US. And the other one kind of clawed her way into it. She comes from Wisconsin. She came up through the restaurant business, not unlike I did, although in a lot of other ways, she doesn't have too much in common with me, but you know, we've got some like handy overlap. Right. And when we meet them, the company that they work for has sort of been plunged into a succession drama because they've got one of these men who like started the whole thing. And all of a sudden he's talking about, is it time for him to step down? And so they suddenly are all trying to vie for that top spot when they see everything getting shaken up. And it just sort of starts to lay bare for them. Can these two women who have always regarded each other as sort of suspicious rivals, can they actually be allies? Can they get more done together than apart? And in the course of forming that relationship, they become close. They also have a lot of conflict. They keep going back and forth between, are they going to be incredibly close to one another? Maybe even business partners, or are they going to go in different directions? Because it's very much about ambition. And can you become the person you are trying to make yourself into? And in their case, can they do it together or do they have to do it alone?
So certainly a part of your book is exploring female friendship as well as female opportunity. And certainly succession dramas. I mean, there have been some real life ones playing out. Honestly, if you go back and look at the whole history of the Red, you know, the Simon at Paramount, Simon and Schuster, you know, mm-hmm. that whole drama. I mean, you couldn't make that up. It was so, and it's still going on because we still don't really know the entire fate of Simon and Schuster. Will they be, you know, vandalized by KKR or will they get, you know, a boast? So succession dramas have been fascinating for millennia, you know, whether it's kingdoms or whether it's an industry or whether. Yeah. So I really did enjoy the drama and the tension that, you know, you brought into the book by having all these people wrestle with it. The ones who thought they were the natural heirs as versus the, you know, the ones who were ambitious or the ones who wanted to opt out, you know, that didn't really want to get into the fight.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things I would ask people when I was sort of doing my research is I would say, well, what are the issues that keep cropping up in your industry? And one of them that they talked about was alcoholism, but another one that they talked about was succession, especially for landowners. And they often made the point that in Europe, you didn't have this as much because it was just, if you grew up in this winemaking family, you were going to take it over. But in America, we didn't necessarily have that same assumption that, you know, you were going to take it over, or we just are so much younger and the industry is so much younger that it's not all established as this hundreds of years of tradition. And so I was really interested to think, how can I use that? Because, you know, with the succession, everything gets laid bare, right? We're all just going along, doing our thing, perfectly happy. And all of a sudden we get a chance to completely change our lives. And it really shows what people think of each other. It shows what you really want. It shows what you're willing to do. So it's a really great storytelling tool.
It absolutely is. And for women, you know, women have more difficult choices sometimes between family and profession. You know, men seem to be able to, you know, get married, have children and carry on. But for women, sometimes, well, oftentimes it's not that easy.
And there's a character in there too, who at one point says, like, you know, Lionel is the one who owns the company, never forgave me for not only having kids, but also talking to them.
Yes, I know. It was a great line. And people oftentimes, you know, I have a small business myself, which I do for fun. So in some ways I'm driven, but in many ways, since I have no financial stake at all in how it goes, you know, I'm not. Mm-hmm. But generally people who can start a business, create a business and whatever it is, are so invested in it. And it's so important to them. It really matters often more than their kids. And so who they leave it to becomes, can become a really hot button issue. If you have multiple children and they're interested in it, which one, you know, gets to dominate, none of your kids care about it. You know, in my case, I'm giving it to my staff because neither of my daughters actually wants to own a bookstore, which is, you know, not a great financial engine, but it does all right. But small businesses therefore often fail with the death or retirement of the owner because often there is no succession plan.
Yeah. And what it takes to make a business successful is not necessarily, you don't necessarily have that in the next generation, because it can be a really singular personality type that's willing to do what it takes to make that happen. And that's a kind of personality type that I love to write about. I'd love to write about people who are a little obsessed with something and a little bit difficult and not entirely, not just an exaggerated version, you know, because that's just great fun for me to write about. And so I would always rather write about somebody who is a little overly passionate about something than not passionate enough.
Yeah, but you know, it's been shown quite clearly over time that people who can start and create something are not necessarily the right people to run it, even mm-hmm. while they're still around. If it becomes successful, I think about Southwest Airlines and Herb, what was his name? Herb Kelleher or something. Anyway, the guy that started Southwest Airlines eventually got booted out because, you know, the mindset that it took to create it was not necessarily the right person to run it. I mean, it's interesting that Jeff Bezos stepped aside, you know, or Bill Gates or some of these tech guys, you know, they go to a certain point and then maybe they're just tired of it.
Yeah. And what it takes to
Elon Musk get tired of it is a question I often ask myself. Why mm-hmm. can't he just retire and get on a rocket and go to the moon or whatever it is, instead of trying to create whatever he's trying to create? Anyway, one of the other things I found really fun about Wine People, which was our August Notable New Fiction of the Month, is that there is a real body of crime fiction that is tied into wine fraud, primarily, i.e. what money can you make from either, well, talk about wine fraud. What did you learn about wine fraud, and how would that lend itself to plotting a crime novel?
Yeah, I actually considered a plot line about that because it is a real issue. I mean, you can imagine, right? There's a lot of money that gets thrown around with wine and people are willing to spend it. And so therefore, you know, where money goes, crime often follows. So it makes perfect sense. And so I did look into that a little bit, but I ended up finding that it didn't feel quite germane to what was most interesting to me. But it makes perfect sense to me that wine fraud would be a huge issue, because how hard can it be, right, to just fill up some bottles and, you know, counterfeit the labels, and people, they're usually not opening it. You open one good bottle, right, and then the rest can all just be fake. And so yeah, I'm not a wine collector, so I'll probably be safe from wine fraud, that, you know, luckily. But
well, I today ran across a new book called Vintage Crime by Rebecca Gibbs. And basically the novel takes on the history of wine, revealing that whether by adding toxic sweeteners or passing off counterfeit bottles, wine fraud is abundant and as old as wine itself. So, yeah. You know, it's a University of California publication. Yeah. I've ordered a copy because I think it'll be fun to read.
Absolutely. That was also one of the things that came up. Originally, I had more about Austria in the book too, but there was a big scandal with, I think it was like glycol or something, that Austrian wine, winemakers were actually adding something toxic to wine however many decades ago. And so it's this very young industry now, because they kind of just had to remake it from the ground up. And so my friend who had worked in wine importing, who was one of my main sources, described going to Austria to deal with all the winemakers there. And she said, everybody was very young, everybody's hip, everybody's beautiful. And you could just feel that this was an industry that there had been started so recently all over again.
Well, when we were in Hungary, I can well remember, because, you know, many of us think about Tokaj and we go, you know, sort of like early rosé is too sweet, whatever. But fascinatingly enough, when the communists came in, as we understand it, one of the things they did, because they wanted to take over everything, was they took over the wine estates, and they had no idea how to run them. And they stuck bureaucrats in, and they, you know, reduced Tokaj to basically lemonade. Or grape aid, I guess I should say. And so it got a really bad reputation, you know, people didn't care about it. When they finally booted the communists out, the old families, many of them, came back and took back over the vineyards. There's a wonderful lake in Hungary, which is their version of Napa Valley. We once took a drive down there and visited various vineyards and, you know, had an alfresco lunch and the whole thing. And tried different Tokaj, tried the bull's blood red that they're making too. But anyway, it's taken them years to overcome the damage that the communists did by, absolutely, you know, thinking they could make wine.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to like rebuild all of the crops and the grapes. Yeah. You know, those are not, it's such a timeless and timely product that it both moves forward relentlessly, and yet you also have to have your eye on the past, you know? So it's kind of a fascinating, again, it's one of those things where it's never going to last very long, and yet it goes on for thousands of years.
And sometimes you have to pick your time. I mean, every time I go to Monticello, they talk about, you know, Jefferson, who was fascinated with wine and brought back wine, you know, cuttings and so forth from France, and then none of them prospered in Virginia. The climate back now today probably would be too warm for wine, but anyway, he could never make it work. Yeah. And he planted it, I think it was on an east-facing slope or something, and I don't know, but anyway, he tried very hard to create an American or Virginia wine industry, but today there actually is a Virginia wine industry that's doing so well. And a woman named Ellen Crosby has written a very good crime series, which is basically set in a fictional Virginia winery. Okay. You know, so timing is a lot. The other thing I think we often forget is that water wasn't a safe thing to drink for a very long time. I can remember reading a series set on the Fourth Cataract, I think it was, on the Nile, back in ancient Egypt, and you couldn't really drink the water. So what they did is they made beer every day. They took bread And they would, you know, whatever it is that you do to ferment bread and water in order to create beer. But the point was that the alcohol purified the water and made it safe to drink. And yeah. I think that's one reason that so many people drank so much. I mean, if you look back at, you know, the quantities, I mean, they used to refer to men as like two or three bottle, you know, he was a three bottle guy or something, sinking three bottles at dinner. And you think, how in the world did anybody do that and get up and walk away from the table? But partly it was because, you know, from an early age, they didn't drink water, they drank wine. And so they got used to it.
Yeah. Of course, my first thought is just wine. Is there anything it can't do? You know, it can purify water, it can do all that stuff, but
it does. Yeah. Yeah, well, alcohol absolutely does. So, you know, it's interesting to me that almost every culture in almost every time has figured out a way to make alcohol, mm-hmm. whether it's vodka from potatoes or, you know, rye from grain or, you know, mm-hmm. whatever it might be. Somehow or other, man has ingeniously always found a way to add alcohol to, well, it has to be water in every case, to add alcohol and turn it into something that, you know, without the fusion, wouldn't exist.
It's such an interesting question too, because yeah, we love that, right? As a species, we are never quite satisfied with just like life as it is. We always have to like alter it just a little bit. We want to sort of get that experience of imagining something that just feels different or is beyond what our daily, you know, mundane life can be. And sometimes people do it for spiritual reasons. Sometimes they do it just for whatever the reason, but you're right. It is an integral part, it seems to me, of being human, that we will always look for that way to just be like, oh, maybe I could mess with it at least a little bit.
Well, I think it can make people feel better. It can, you know, alter your whatever, but also for a very long time, it was almost the only anesthesia available.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, people about to undergo some sort of ghastly surgical procedure or something, they would get them drunk because that was really the only way to kind of lower the pain threshold. So, you know, it's a fascinating subject. Are you intending to do anything more, or is this basically a one-off book and you're going to progress to some other subject?
I'm not sure. You know, I've written about the restaurant industry. I've written about, you know, other food and wine in more sort of indirect ways. And so I can't imagine that I won't write about it again in some way, shape or form. But I'm not quite sure exactly how I will do it. And it's always that thing where you don't want to repeat yourself over and over again, but you also know the topics that you love and that kind of get you excited to write and to tell stories in. And as we've been talking, I mean, obviously there are so many stories to be told within the wine world that it would not shock me if I end up writing about this again.
There are some wonderful food writers, some of which write just about food, but some of whom create stories. I'm having a blank, a factor of old age, on the gourmet editor, Ruth.
Is that Ruth Reichel, yeah.
Yeah, Ruth Reichel, who's written some fiction. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think some of her books are extraordinary, some of them about her own career. Mm-hmm. As a food critic and so forth, but some of them have been other kinds of fiction, and you know, wine has played roles certainly in all of that. And didn't she write one called Comfort Me with Apples? I think
yes. She had that whole series of memoirs that were about, you know, her life in food and her career in food writing and food editing. And I love her work. I think she's wonderful. And I don't know if you ever read anything by Gabrielle Hamilton. She's just written one memoir, but it contains some of my all-time favorite food writing in the first couple of chapters. She's a chef, actually. She had a restaurant called Prune in New York City for a number of years until the pandemic. And she is a brilliant writer has this moment of talking about being a child sitting on her mother's lap after dinner. And there's something about the physicality of like that moment and what it means to be like a parent and a child and how close physical that relationship is. And everything she writes about food, I will happily read.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that. Maybe you could drop me an email and remind
Absolutely.
Me. I would really appreciate that. I have personally never forgiven Cy Newhouse for dropping gourmet in favor of whatever.
I was very upset about that. Yeah.
I've never, ever understood the rationale behind it. But gourmet not only took you all over the world and, you know, was wonderful with food, but once again, wine was always, you know, an important part of it. So yeah, I mean, if you're interested in writing about food, certainly memoir is one way to go, or actual food is another, but there's boundless fiction. that you can create out of, you know, there's been a lot of interest in it in the streaming age that we have, you know, embarked upon. There have been many. Did you watch? I don't know if you've ever watched MHC TV. It's Margaret Henry Zebra TV, which is a foreign language only. It's where Call My Agent debuted and, you know, things like that. They had a 2-season series called Chef, just Chef. And it was set in Paris, and it involved an amazing French restaurant. And it went through all the drama about, you know, financing and personnel and succession and all the rest of it. And we were so intrigued with it that when we went to Lisbon shortly thereafter, my husband found a restaurant like it, and he booked us a table in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. We got to sit there for like 14 courses, you know, which were minuscule, obviously, and watch them all work. And it felt as though we were actually in the drama. And then there's been, I think there's one set in Chicago, isn't there? There's
Bear.
What's it called?
The Bear.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not just books that are taking, that are involved in the food and wine industry, but there's, you know, lots of drama as well. Have you ever written a screenplay? Have you ever thought about that?
I've thought about it. I haven't done it. My first book was made into a movie, and I, at the time, was like, maybe I should try to, you know, write a screenplay. But, you know, the trouble for me with screenplays is that I love all of the language stuff. I love being able to give you all of the atmosphere and the description. And that is all the stuff that you really should not do in a screenplay. Everybody else has to do it. So screenplays are all about structure and dialogue, and, you know, it's all in the conception. So I think it would do me a lot of good as a writer to write one, but it would mostly serve to benefit my fiction, I think. So I just wouldn't want to give up that language and all the other stuff that I get to do in a novel.
I had this discussion Monday night when launching Nelson DeMille and his son in their new work. And the son is a screenwriter. And we talked about, you know, 100 pages for a screenplay versus 490 pages for the novel they just wrote, and how difficult it is to, you know, to go either direction. It's hard for people used to writing screenplays to recognize that the actor and the set aren't with you, and you have to actually use words for that. But then it's very hard for a novelist to, you know, whack through their cherished prose and all the rest of it, and also recognize that, you know, the set and the actor may very well change the physicality that's conveyed in the novel. But I think it would be an interesting exercise, you know, if I were an author. I think it would be fascinating to do that, but maybe on somebody else's work rather than your own.
It might be easier on somebody else's work. Yeah, just because you could see it more clearly. I mean, when my book was made into a movie, I had completely detached from it, because I just knew it was like, this is out of my hands. This is somebody else's art form, and this is somebody else's project now, and they're going to do with the story what they need to do. And that was the right attitude, because you really have no control over what they're going to do with it. And if anything, I was shocked when I was like, oh, that sounds familiar. I'm like, oh, I wrote that. Like, that was my dialogue. No wonder it sounded familiar to me. But it's so collaborative, film. And in a novel, the joy and the struggle is that it's all you. You know, you can bring people in to give you ideas, and you can share your work, but it's all down to you. So
tell us about Zippy Books. I love to support new, smaller, independent publishers. I think they're adventurous. What interested you in bringing your novel to Zibby Books?
Yeah, you know, I had worked with Lee Newman, who was originally one of the ones who started it with Zibby, and I worked with her as an editor for her wonderful writing many years ago, and so I knew of her already. And when my agent and I heard about what they were trying to do, I think that one of the ways they described what they were looking for as stories about women or by women with a strong sense of place and a strong sort of sense of story and interesting characters, it was like, that's all the stuff that I want to do. You know, I am much more interested in an immersive story than I am in, say, a story that is playing with form or being really avant-garde. Like, I'm just going to drop you in, and I'm going to do my best to just pull you along. And so I was really delighted when they wanted to publish Wine People. And, you know, they're also, it's crazy because it's a new press. I think mine is like the 7th book to be published. They're doing just one a month. So everybody kind of gets their moment in the sun, and then it sort of keeps on going. You're building the plane while you're flying the plane, which is always tricky. But they really have put their all into supporting the writers and supporting the books and trying to find those ways to get you, you know, out and going to like great places. I just spent a bunch of time in California and wine country, which is wonderful. And they just really take good care of you and do everything that they can to get it out there and to be successful. So it's been really wonderful.
That's great. I've enjoyed working with them. I'm trying to remember, you might be the third author. I'd have to go back and look. But anyway, that we work with, and they are indeed a pleasure. I feel like publishing will survive if more publishers like Zibi come into the picture, because the currently five, and let's hope they actually stay five, major houses have, you know, overheads and all kinds of things to contend with. I'm very interested, and I haven't yet ordered anything from it. Have you heard about Sibylline Press?
No, I don't think I have.
Sibylline. It is a press, something like Zibi in its kind. But anyway, it exists to publish books by women over 50 who are selling, you know, it has a specific age level there. And I can't remember whether it is cooperative in the sense that, you know, it's not quite like a traditional publisher, whether the author has to participate in part in the publishing process. I honestly can't remember. But I did see when I was looking at, do you know, this week there were 397 new novels released?
I did not know that, but that doesn't shock me. But yeah,
I can't keep up. I am absolutely flabbergasted by the sheer volume. And the thing is, the more you're interested in looking outside the major industry for smaller things and trying to highlight them, the more you expand your workload to something that, you know, our newsletter, somebody pointed out to me recently, is almost becoming too long to read. So, you know, now I have to think about, it's that old thing about if I had more time, I'd write shorter. And since I have to write one every single month, it's easier to sort of cut and paste than, you know, just for the typing alone. And I think about that, how am I ever going to like squish these down so they're still interesting for people, but I can still cover a wider array of books than, you know, just like the standard stuff that you can find in any bookstore.
And you'll see covered anywhere. And so like part of, you know, the value is saying, well, here are these other things that you haven't heard of, but you know, there's so many things out there. It's so much noise and so many different projects that it's wonderful that so many people are doing that, because I believe in the book. But at the same time, you know, it can be a struggle to sort of be like, I'm here as well, you know, because there's just so much going on out there. So
it really is. You know, you feel like you're a guide kind of hacking your way along a path in the forest while the trees are growing up around you. But so anyway, that's one reason that I have paid attention to Zibi Books, and I've found them so cooperative because I want to support them. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we call Patrick up to see if we've had any questions or comments from the audience?
I mean, I think I probably would just talk a little bit, Leslie, about the novel, and just to say that, you know, one of the things that was really important to me in writing this book was to write about ambition, to write about the beauties of the wine industry, and to have a lot of fun with travel and with food. Was that I didn't want it to be, it has a lot of drama, but I didn't want it to be too serious. I think that sometimes when people think about wine, they, even though it has become so much more casual and democratized, which I think is so much more fun than it used to be, I do think there's a feeling of like, oh, is this going to be really serious? And I didn't want the book to be like that. I wanted it to be much more dynamic and fun and have a little bit of, you know, sense of humor and wit to it. So I think it's a really great book if you want to travel a little bit in your head and you want to think about eating. And also the great part about this is that, you know, if you're drinking wine while you read this book, you're really doing it for literature. And so you can just do that as much as you want. And I hope that helps.
I love that. I think that's a great way to look at it. What do you think about the cover? I was really entranced with the cover.
I love the cover.
The art.
You know, you don't have a lot of control over covers as a writer. And so this was one of the first times when I really felt like I actually really both love it and was surprised by it. Because so often you get a cover and you're like, well, I really like it, it's kind of exactly what I thought it might be or something, because it's design is tough, you know, having to like come up with this thing that feels like surprising and right. And somebody found the illustration, actually, Grasa, who is Zibi's assistant, was just deciding that she wasn't quite loving the cover direction we had. And so she found this illustration and licensed it. Well, first decided to see, you know, make a mock-up and see what we thought. And we all fell in love with it. There was just like unanimous happiness with this cover. So I'm delighted with it. I look at it all the time. People talk to me about it all the time.
I think it has a playful sense. It, mm-hmm. you know, it helps convey the spirit that you wrote the book in. Patrick, come back and join us. And perhaps since we ended on talking about the cover, you can hold up a copy since I can't, and show it to us again.
Sure.
You have one. Okay, wonderful.
I carry it with me everywhere I go.
Oh, good. I was really taken. And to be honest, I asked for a copy of the book based on the cover without knowing anything about it, because I was, which, you know, is what a cover should do, right? It should really hook people in. Right. So, Patrick, any questions or anything you'd like to ask?
Well, I was just noticing, Michelle, that you've done a lot of editorial work as well. Is it difficult to kind of keep, because they seem to occupy separate parts, separate lobes of the brain. Would mm-hmm. you agree with that one? How has your editorial work kind of affected your own writing? Are you able to work with an editor in a different way, maybe? Or
yeah, you know, it has a really interesting back and forth, because when I first started getting experience as an editor, it was very helpful to me because I no longer felt like I no longer felt that if anybody had a criticism of my writing, that meant I was terrible and, you know, just stop doing this. But I, you know, you do feel that raw when you first go into it, because I realized that as an editor, I was just trying to make this thing work better, basically. And so I got a lot tougher about it. What has happened to me more recently is that because I'm a freelance editor, and so that's what I do all the time, is that sometimes the struggle is to find the quiet of all the stories that are in my head between teaching and editorial work, to find the quiet space to just be able to write and to generate something new. That can be hard. And so you have to sort of protect a little bit of the mental space to do that and never think about an editor in that first draft. That first draft it's so easily squashed. You know, you just have to like protect it for a while and pretend that an editor will never see it. And it's not until it's stronger that then you can even admit that editors exist and will be ready to critique it for you.
Do you use Stet a lot?
Sometimes I do. I'm actually fairly relaxed in a lot of ways about taking edits, because I'm, you know, the giver of edits so often that I feel like I have to be. But I do have certain voice things, or, you know, certain moments where I'm like, no, that's exactly what I wanted to say and how I wanted to say it. And so then the Stet comes out.
Right. Now, what about the process of writing in general? Mm-hmm. Is there a part of it that you like most? Do you like getting the story out, the first draft? Or do you like going back in and kind of, you know, honing it down and shaping it? And
yeah, that's always such a good question, because I do find most writers are one or the other. Like, we either really love one thing or we really love the other. And I am more of a reviser than a drafter. And it was a big relief to me to hear somebody say that most writers really appreciate one part of the process more than the other, because I find that first draft really difficult. And there was a part of me that wondered if I'm finding the writing so difficult in writing, should I stop writing? You know, like if this is so hard for you, maybe this isn't going very well. And for me, there's something about getting that beginning, middle, and end, no matter how messy and Frankenstein-y that first draft is, where I start to think of it differently. And then I just feel like, okay, I can move on to the next phase. And there's some relief in feeling like at least I got to that milestone. And now I can start messing with this thing as much as I want to. I just feel a greater level of comfort at that point.
So as a corollary question, do you know where you're going when you start, or as you write, does the story develop and surprise you?
It's sort of both. I usually have to know generally where I am headed. You know, if nothing else, I should know, is it a tragedy or is it a comedy? Am I headed up or am I tearing these people down? But I don't know everything. And if I know too much, then it often winds up being a little too simple in structure. If you aren't paying attention to the things you notice about your characters by living with them and watching what they do, when I do that, I come up with more interesting stuff. So what I've gotten better at is maybe I don't know exactly where I'm headed, but I can get better at creating a story generating situation, so that the better I know my characters in the world and I give them something out of balance, something they have to react to, that helps me figure out what comes next.
What about some of, who do you like to read? Do you have any influences, or where are you from?
I have certain writers that I read to remind myself why I wanted to write. And so for me, like, I'll often read just a few pages of them when I'm trying to get into a writing mode. So Laurie Colwin is one of those, also a wonderful food writer who wrote in Gourmet for many years. You might've read her stuff. And MFK Fisher was one of my early, like, this is why I love food, why I love wine. But she just wrote about food as a lens to talk about people. And that's what got my attention. I love Alice Munro, who, you know, works almost entirely in short stories. She has one novel and scores of stories, but she can do anything she wants, I think, in a short story. She can kind of do anything she wants on the page, period. And then I don't think I'm ever going to write a mystery, but I love to read them as something that where I can just get drawn in and completely enjoy them. And I don't read it like an editor. I just get to be a reader. So I turn to things like, I'll read Michael Connelly a lot. I read a bunch of Donna Leon's, although I've gotten behind on her series. But there's a number of those that are my favorites and I look forward to them. Those yearly people who come out and you're like, oh, good, here's another one.
You know, that's so interesting because only 4 hours ago, I talked to Donna.
I saw that on your YouTube and I was like, oh, Donna. Yeah.
Well, you can watch it. You can also listen to podcasts. One of the things that we have found that has been so successful that started with the pandemic when we all had to, you know, thank God Zoom came along at the right moment, we're at something like 252,000 downloads of the podcasts. So for people who don't have time to watch them, you can listen to them. But you really ought to watch Donna if you're a fan. She has some really good things to say today.
Oh, great. And also talk about somebody who uses place so beautifully and uses food so beautifully, you know, so I think she's a real pleasure to read. I love her work.
And the defining, she thinks that the thing she enjoys the most about writing is humor. She loves the humor that she puts into the books and she loves it when people recognize it.
Yeah.
So you have a bond there.
Nice. Thank you.
You know who I love is Michelle, is Jim Harrison. His novels, but also his food writing too.
Yeah.
You know, he did a couple of, at least one memoir that was specifically about food. But he's kind of this larger than life sort of throwback to an earlier era.
Yeah. You know, yeah, I think of him as one of those kind of classic food and wine writers who's, you know, I feel like all the wine that he always talked about was French. You know, he was often like hunting game birds or something like that. But,
exactly.
Yeah.
I once met him. I saw him at an event down in Tucson and he's holding forth, you know, inside the bookstore with a glass of wine and a cigarette the entire time, you know, just kind of, this was probably back in the mid to late 90s, but what a character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Let's see. There's actually something else I was going to ask you and it's gone. I lost it. Maybe it'll come back.
So we were talking about wine and crime. I can say that Peter Mayle, who many of you might have known for A Year in Provence, actually wrote, I think, three crime novels about wine, Americans on the Riviera, and wine money, wine fraud, and so forth. Was a background to it. So I remember being surprised when I, you know, saw that but I think maybe he'd said everything he had to say about, you know, living in Provence and he needed some new focus. But for those who might be interested in wine and crime, I could certainly recommend Peter.
What about Martin Walker?
Well, Martin Walker, do you know Martin Walker's books?
I don't know.
Oh, start with Bruno, Chief of Police, and you can read your way through. And there is finally a cookbook coming. Donna's publisher in Switzerland, Diogenes, is also Martin's European publisher. He's an actual former head of UPI and whatever. He is writing about a village in the Dordogne, or actually, well, I think of it as Dordogne. But anyway, in the course of the books, it's so much of it is all about food and local wine. And Martin has become, by living there in a village, some kind of fancy medieval wine master. You know, there are photos of him when he's all robed up and he looks like a monk or something with, you know. But you would really enjoy them and the food. And it's the Périgord. That's what it is. And when I was there, I developed a huge fondness for Sancerre, which is strangely hard to find in American restaurants. and often hugely expensive.
Yeah, but it is one of my favorite whites, I have to say.
Yeah, it has that kind of, you know, granity, steely kind of a little bit of a taste to it. And locally, a restaurant that I am at all the time imports a Basque wine for me called Chocolina, which is a little bit like a Vino Verde, but stronger. But it has just a little teeny bite, you know, a little teeny bit of effervescence as it goes down.
A good friend of mine has a wine store right in the neighborhood, and I just basically drink what she tells me to drink. And she has a Chocolina that was really lovely, and we drank a lot over the summer.
So good. They really are. Well, anyway, it's been wonderful to wax on here about wine and stories and all the rest of it. Patrick, is there anything else?
Let me check. No, I don't think so.
All right. Well, Michelle, it's really been a great pleasure. Thank you for your great insights. I've learned so much by talking to you this evening.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Well, and I appreciate your signing Wine People for us back in August. And I hope that you or Zippy will keep us apprised. Do you have a 2-book contract with them?
No, I still have to write the next book. I have to start thinking about that next thing. So got to figure it out.
All right. Well, I'm sure we'll hear from you again. But so wish you luck and happy holiday season. Thank you all very much for joining us this evening. All of you who are watching, good night.
Thank you.
Good night. Good night. Thanks.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.